I'm Alex Perrine. I'm a staff writer at The New Republic.
And I'm Laura Marsh, the magazine's literary editor.
This is The Politics of Everything, a show about the intersection of culture, media, and politics.
Today, we're talking about the three most unpredictable months in politics, the period after the election in November and before the inauguration in January.
Why does that period exist?
What sort of trouble have past outgoing presidents made?
And what can we expect this time around?
This is The Politics of Everything.
So, Laura, the idea for this episode was yours. Why did you want to talk to a whole bunch of people about the period of transition between Election Day and the inauguration?
Well, the period between the election on November 3rd and inauguration in January 20th is nearly 3 months. And this struck me as just being an incredibly long time. Where I'm from in the UK, if you win an election, you come into office the next day. And lots of places, you don't wait that long to get into power once you've won an election. And during this campaign, you start to wonder what that president could do, because we know that if Joe Biden were to win, Trump would be in office for that time. During the campaign, he has hinted that he might not accept the results of the election. He has responded to chants from his supporters of 4 more years by saying, you say 8 more years. Mm-hmm. He's broken all these norms around leaving office already that make you wonder what he could do in a period between November 3rd and January 20th to make things difficult for Joe Biden if Joe Biden won the election.
And the subject itself almost requires that we talk as if we are certain Joe Biden will win the election, but we absolutely are not.
Right. And I think it's too late to wait for Joe Biden to win the election and then to start wondering what could happen during a transition period and how these transition periods tend to play out. So I think one of the things that we want to ask our guests is what we should be doing to prepare.
And of course, no discussion of what Donald Trump might do is complete without a pundit or journalist worrying that you are giving him ideas. So I would like to make it really clear that if you are Donald Trump, please turn off this podcast right now.
This is not a brainstorm for anyone in the Trump administration.
So first, we decided we wanted to learn about the history of this transition period.
So we're joined by Michael Kazin, a professor of history at Georgetown University and co-editor of Dissent. Our first question is, where does this long period come from? Why do we have it?
Well, it comes from a couple of things, I think. One, the fact that the United States began as an agrarian nation, and we still have the same crazy electoral college that we began with, which has changed very little since 1789, the Constitution was ratified. And so the period between Election Day and when the president actually took power, people had to go a long distance by horse, by boat, to get to their state capitals very often, where the Electoral College actually voted. And then Congress had to count those votes. That it took even longer for many congressmen to get from wherever they lived to Washington, D.C., to open Congress and actually count the votes. Also, you know, we have this system, as you know, where there's the executive branch is completely separate from the legislative branch. It takes time to prepare the new administration, whereas in Britain, for example, there's a shadow cabinet each major party has, and so they're ready to take over. The prime minister can move into 10 Downing Street very quickly.
So part of it is just technology. For hundreds of years, it just took a very long time to conduct an election in a country the size of the United States, which was also growing during that time.
Yes.
So in the 1780s, or let's say the 1810s, someone gets elected. Presumably, they've been campaigning for a long time. They're eager to get into office. Was there any worry in those early decades that a delay would kind of slow down or hamper the agenda of the incoming president? Because it is unusual. And in many countries, you're elected, you take office the next day, and you are able to start to push your mandate forward.
That's very true. But the United States began without parties. In fact, the framers of the Constitution disliked parties intensely. And so the idea was everybody, every man who became president would be a sort of natural aristocrat, as some of the founding fathers called them. There would be good faith between all members of this elite. There's an assumption behind the creators of the system and the way the system's supposed to run that there'll be a peaceful, amicable transfer of power between one president and another president.
How long did it take for that idea to completely go wrong?
Well, the first time we went wrong was pretty early, the fourth election and the second really competitive election of 1800, when none of the candidates for the presidency won a majority of the electoral vote. And when that happens, the House elects the president. And so the battle shifted to the House. By the way, that's another reason why there's this long period in between, because the Founding Fathers understood that, well, a lot of times the election would be decided in the House of Representatives, because they thought maybe 5, 6, 7 people would run for president and none would win a majority of the electoral vote. And then the House would decide. When the House elects the president, each House delegation has one vote. So Wyoming has the same vote as California, one vote. I mean, something like 15% of the American population could elect the president if it went to the House.
Do we have examples of mischief-making by presidents on the way out?
Well, yes. I mean, nothing like trying to stop them from taking office. But, well, for instance, you know, one of the most famous Supreme Court cases in history, really the one that established the power of judicial review by the court, took place because John Adams, when he was on his way out of the presidency, after he lost the election of 1800, to Thomas Jefferson, he appointed a few federal judges. They're called midnight judges. He did it right before he was about to leave office. And the case was brought by Jefferson's administration saying, this is illegitimate. Another example, I guess, Herbert Hoover, after he lost the 1932 election to Franklin Roosevelt, tried to get FDR to sign on to an agreement that he would not do anything different from what Hoover had done to solve the Great Depression. He basically said, everything I've done, you should not go beyond it. You should not take on more federal debt. You should not take the country in a completely new direction. And Roosevelt, of course, was having none of it. But that was an example of how an outgoing president tried his best to hinder the actions of the incoming president. Mm-hmm.
We don't travel by horse anymore. We have the internet. People can drive places. It doesn't take that long for people to vote. Could these dates be moved?
Well, it's a bill. It can be changed. Election day was set in the 1840s to be on one day. It used to be states could vote different times. So it used to be Maine voted earlier. So there's an old saying in the 19th century, as Maine goes, so goes the nation, because Maine voted earlier.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's hard to imagine our elections being even more chaotic than they are now, but apparently they were.
Oh, yeah.
But the inauguration date actually used to be even later than January 20th. They did move it.
Yes, it used to be March 4th, and that was because of weather. The election day was set November 4th by Congress in the 1840s because the harvest was over. It wasn't too cold yet. And inauguration day was originally set for March 4th because winter would be over in most parts of the country, at least the really bad weather.
But they moved it because they felt it was too long.
Yeah. By the 1930s, which is when they changed it, you know, there were trains. There were even planes.
So in theory, we could change it again.
Yes, very much so. Congress can change it anytime it wants to.
Do you think that could cut down on some of the potential chaos of the transitions? Would it force people to be more organized? I mean, I know that it's definitely a lot of work to make all these appointments, but there's clearly a great degree of prep that can be done by a well-funded presidential campaign.
That's certainly true. And I think the main problem, again, we're getting back to the Electoral College. If the popular vote decided things, in most cases, the popular vote would not be that close. It wouldn't be based on the popular vote in one state or another, which, of course, had Electoral College votes. For example, in 2016, everyone would have known by midnight that day when California voted that Hillary Clinton had the plurality of the popular votes. So she could start preparing to take office the next day.
So now that we have the history of this period, we thought it would be useful to talk to some people about what Trump might do in the event of a Biden victory.
Hi, I'm Walter Shapiro, covering my 11th presidential campaign as a staff writer for the New Republic. I think what Trump is going to do is deflate like an oversized balloon at the magnitude of the rejection. To end with Trump announcing he has so many exciting business opportunities around the world that while he would win a contested election if it went to the courts, at the urging of Ivanka and Jared, it really is the only thing he can do for the company. It's the ever-shrinking Donald Trump hope and dream.
Your optimistic scenario, it strikes me as essentially following something people assumed about Trump 4 years ago, which is that he didn't necessarily run to be president and do the things presidents have to do. I don't think it's unreasonable to imagine that he would say he's not enjoying being president and that he would just come up with an excuse to save face and tuck his tail and run, right?
Yeah, I'm starting off with the idea the American people don't deserve me.
Yeah.
I also think that Donald Trump may not show up for the inauguration,
mm-hmm.
that he will be en route to Mar-a-Lago as Biden is being sworn in. And we have never had a situation in modern times where the outgoing president didn't ride to the inauguration with the incoming president, even though in cases like Eisenhower and Truman in 52, Carter and Reagan in 1980, they were not speaking, but they were at least symbolically in the same place.
I have to say, a scenario where Trump is in Mar-a-Lago while Joe Biden is getting inaugurated, unprecedented though it may be, does not sound like a particularly bad scenario to
me. Oh, God, I would bronze that split screen.
Yeah, I think that's still going to be our best case scenario in this episode. Walter, I really hope that you're right.
I just think that assuming the worst, while often good, in the middle of a pandemic, let's have a little hope.
My name is Jason Linkins. I'm a deputy editor at The New Republic. I think that what we can say about Donald Trump is that he has few really good political ideas. But one thing he's proven to be very agile at is raising the question of the legitimacy of an election. It's a seed he sort of instinctively knew to plant way, way out in the 2016 cycle, you know, suggesting that the Democratic primary was rigged. At midnight on election night, we'll have an electoral map, we'll have votes being counted, and it will tell one story at midnight that night. But what could happen in the hours, days, potentially weeks to come, that votes will come in, they will trickle inevitably into the Democratic column and potentially shift states that look very much like they're toss-ups, perhaps even leaning in Trump's favor, over into the Democratic column. I can easily imagine him getting on Twitter and starting to just sort of like raise a ruckus about illegitimacy. I mean, he has nothing to lose by doing so, really. In 2000, we had a disputed election on election night between George W. Bush and Al Gore. And the media called it one way, they had to uncall it. And the days that followed were a huge mess. There were the famous Brooks Brothers riots in which well-clad men attempted to actually breach the room in which people were counting votes. It all ended up in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided in Bush's favor. What I can say is that the media has really struggled. They have rhetorically undermined the legitimacy of elections. So in 2018, on a midnight on election night, this is the off-year election, the story that emerged immediately was not so much a blue wave, a respectable Democratic showing. And of course, there were all these races still being counted, a lot of them out in California. And those shifted in the Democrats' favor. And we finally ended up with the blue wave story that many had predicted. During that period of time, the media threw a lot of shade on the way California was going about their business. Why haven't they finished this yet? How can we trust this result is legit? It's taking so long. Those little things tend to wear away at the legitimacy of what's being done. And Republicans at that time glommed onto that and they made hay out of it. And from my perspective, I was sitting there thinking, well, if the job's worth doing is worth doing well, and if it takes more time than midnight on the day to do it, why do we have a problem about it? And why does the media drive this kind of skepticism about it?
Part of the framing of this show is around the quirk that the U.S. has such a long period between election night and inauguration. How much do you think having that time makes the election more insecure?
It's a really good question. I still don't think necessarily that the actual existence of this period of time is necessarily bad. I definitely think it creates a lot of room to get creative if you wanted to with delegitimizing the election. So in that way, you know, it could be several weeks of dangerous nonsense.
So we've talked about what it might look like if Donald Trump disputes the results of the election.
But even if he doesn't dispute the results, it could still be a time of great chaos. So after the break, we're going to talk to Libby Watson, Melissa Jira Grant, and Matt Ford about a couple of different areas in which Trump could do damage during those 3 months.
If Trump loses, what could the following 3 months look like? What kind of damage could he do during that period?
I'm Libby Watson, and I'm a staff writer at The New Republic. I think one of the scariest things that he could do in those last few weeks is undermining faith in public health leaders and officials. It could go as far as firing people that Biden would need to adequately respond to coronavirus.
Right.
You know, the Biden team is supposed to be talking to Donald Trump's team about setting up a government. And there is just so many conceivable roadblocks and, you know, fights.
We've already seen his style of management seemingly make the CDC and the FDA have a poorer response to this than they would have otherwise. If the Biden transition team is in there trying to work with career staff CDC people, he could just be like firing them left and right if he really wanted to.
Yeah, exactly. Or you know, making them talk to Jared Kushner instead. It doesn't necessarily have to be Trump doing some kind of like nefarious scheme to screw things up for Joe Biden, although that could happen too. Just his normal brand of, you know, like grifty incompetence could be incredibly dangerous in this period.
The CDC is telling hospitals to get ready to deliver a vaccine that doesn't exist yet in November.
Right.
If he's undermining faith in public health officials, it could go so far as to sort of undermine faith in any effective response to keeping COVID-19 under control during that period.
Right. All along, he's been pushing for this imaginary vaccine to be approved and shipped for the election. But, you know, I can imagine that reversing very quickly and just sort of spitefully, if he loses, saying, well, I don't need everybody to get their vaccine by next week anymore. And so he could have rushed us to this point where, you know, a potentially unproven, ineffective vaccine could be rushed to market, and then he just kind of wanders off, you know, 10 minutes after the election. It's like, all right, you guys got this, right? And so we could end up with this huge disaster where, you know, we have this vaccine approved and ready, which may or may not work, but just no leadership at the top to actually get it distributed to people, which is already going to be just an insanely mammoth task for any administration.
I'm Matt Ford, and I'm a staff writer at The New Republic. The areas that the president would be most powerful are things like immigration, foreign policy, and criminal justice. In other areas, he's sort of bound by the fact that Congress would have to act or that the courts would have to act. So we don't really have to worry about him pursuing like trumped-up charges against Joe Biden and trying to, you know, arrest him within 3 months. One of the areas I'm most concerned about, and this is something that's sort of bubbled beneath the surface but hasn't really sort of received a broad amount of public attention, is the destruction of government records, documents relating to CBP and ICE. And I'm thinking about records involving, you know, detainee mistreatment, sexual assaults at the facilities on the border, records related to the family separation policy, sort of covering their tracks. And the other sphere is the areas related to the White House and its foreign relations. We know from the impeachment saga that Trump has, like past presidents, transcripts of his calls with foreign leaders. Obviously, he's closely guarding those, maybe for nefarious reasons, maybe not. But you have to wonder if he's sort of going to take some of them with him, delete them off servers as he leaves, and sort of hobble the next administration's ability to see what he's been up to. And the foreign policy aspect is also particularly concerning, because that's an area where the president has traditionally been held to have a broad, limitless authority beyond actually waging war with other countries. And even then, that's kind of questionable. You know, you have to wonder if he has 3 months left, whether he tries to withdraw from NATO or whether he tries to withdraw from NAFTA. Those treaties have provisions that sort of prevent the country from withdrawing immediately. In theory, it's supposed to take a year. But you can also see him trying to undermine those treaties in practice, doing things like removing U.S. troops from Europe and South Korea, using the president's inherent trade authority to slap more steel tariffs on Canada or new auto tariffs on Mexico.
So the issue that he would be creating there would just be creating a lot of mess for Joe Biden to have to clean up in the first months of his presidency, which would stop him implementing other stuff that he needs to get done.
Right.
Right.
Even in a normal presidency, the transition is an extraordinarily busy time. The entire federal government, some 2 million employees, basically have to turn over from one set of bosses to the other. And that involves a lot of briefings, a lot of documents being prepared, a lot of records being kept, office space being rented out, security clearances being fast-tracked. So you have the twin threat of Trump maybe trying to sabotage the transition by sort of slow-walking some of these procedures, by hampering other ones, and then by adding chaos to the mix. You know, something like withdrawing troops in South Korea chews up a lot of time and energy in a presidential administration, especially at the start of it when you're trying to hire some 4,000 appointees, when you're trying to get your White House staff together. To sidetrack all that energy would be an enormous drain on an incoming Biden administration.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think about a threat in this last 3 months to the courts? Is there a chance that he would make a lot of appointments at this time?
Well, he can't do much to add more judges to the courts. It's not because he doesn't want to, it's because he can't. There are simply not very many vacancies left to fill. That said, he would technically retain the power to do that through the transition. And so if you imagine a circumstance where a Supreme Court justice were to retire on, say, November 15th, you know, 2 weeks after we know the results, there would theoretically be nothing to stop Trump and McConnell from simply packing in a Supreme Court justice on their way out. And because of the impeachment clause, there'd basically be no way to remove them afterwards.
What other mischief are you particularly concerned about?
One of the areas I'm most concerned about are things like mass pardons for his associates. And that includes people who still are awaiting their sort of ticket to be punched out of the Russia investigation, people like Paul Manafort, people like Michael Flynn. It includes former political allies who've been caught up in completely separate legal imbroglios, Duncan Hunter, Chris Collins, two of his earliest congressional endorsers. These are people that would naturally be predisposed by Trump, given his track record, to receive some sort of clemency. Where this gets into some really interesting territory or potentially troubling territory is if he starts to use it more aggressively, if he starts to offer pardons in exchange for criminal behavior. And we know that he has proposed doing this before. He said to the Border Patrol agents last year that if they need to break a few laws to keep people out, and I'm paraphrasing here, that they can expect a pardon if a judge tries to slap them on the wrist for it. And if you apply that in other contexts, you can set some pretty troubling precedents. And finally, you know, for pardons, the thing he could do is try to pardon himself. That's not something that's ever been done before. I don't believe at the federal or state level. But you can have him easily imagine saying that, look, hey, you can't prosecute me now. The deep state can't get me.
So what would that mean? That would protect him from any future prosecution.
Right. Explain the pardon power exactly.
The self-pardon.
The self-pardon would be preemptive, right?
Right. So it's inherited from the English tradition. And in the American context, it applies in all but two situations. One is it has to be a criminal act. You can't use it to like get out of EPA regulations. And the second is that it has to be a federal crime. All the president basically has to do is write it down and it takes legal effect. There's a famous example during the Civil War where General Hooker sent an envelope with a couple dozen death sentences for President Lincoln of deserters who tried to flee the Union Army. He took the envelope, wrote pardon on it, and sent it back. You know, it's entirely possible that at 11:59 on January 20th, he could simply write on Twitter that I pardon myself for any crimes committed between January 20th of 2017 and now. You know, obviously the only way to test that would be to try to prosecute him.
Do you think that tweet is already drafted? I bet that's in his drafts folder already.
Yeah, I've actually held off on writing that article because I'm worried that I'm going to give him ideas that he can.
No, you're
going
to give him the idea. I hope he's not listening to the pod.
I figured this would be a safe space to voice that. And I know law professors who've kind of like hinted that and then quickly deleted it. Mm-hmm. Because it's not something you really want to put out there into the world, like nuclear fission.
I'm Melissa Jarrett Grant, and I'm a staff writer at The New Republic. So, you know, here we are before the election, and Trump is already casting doubt on any result in which he loses. if he wants to run with that, I think there are people who would back him on that with violence. Since the uprisings around George Floyd and seeing how, you know, various right-wing formations have reacted to that, like Back the Badge, Blue Lives Matter, and their fellow travelers among militia groups, it all seems to be sort of like teaming up is the wrong word, because I don't think there's a lot of coherence here.
Yeah.
But there's certainly a lot of people who are willing to get out in the streets. And I think that's actually the real danger of some of these rallies. They are about mobilizing people. And you put all of that together, and I don't think Trump would like declare a martial law or anything like that organized. But I do think that he could inspire people to commit acts of vigilante violence who would believe that the police would stand aside, because that's what's happening right now.
So the idea here, though, isn't that necessarily Trump would use those vigilante groups to stay in power past the 4-year limit, but that they would be working to create a very threatening atmosphere and outbreaks of violence during the transition period.
And that sort of informal or disorganized violence, that could then inspire a federal crackdown in turn. You know, and then Trump, as he is now, would show up and say, call us into your cities, let us restore order, right? And then what does that lead to? I don't know if the FBI is going to listen when senators and the president himself are saying things like investigate Antifa. But I do think there's enough support within the government that you would see that in some form backing up what's going on in the streets.
So one thing we've been talking about with everyone is transitions, handing over, and the idea that unless Trump did try to steal an election, which is an idea that's also come up, he would eventually leave office and Joe Biden will be able to remake some of these agencies. But the groups you're talking about are non-government actors, militias, vigilantes, and these are some of the groups that are notoriously the hardest to get a handle on. You cannot vote them out. They're not voted in. They're unofficial. They're disorganized. So what are the long-term consequences of a period of, say, 3 months of unrestrained activity from those kinds of groups long-term?
I wouldn't put it past the moment that we're in, to be honest. These groups could be very useful in that transition period to just leave us with a sense of chaos or unfinished business from the election. Like, I think that that's really like the narrative that they would be responding to. You know, we're here to protect our lawfully elected leader who should be here.
So we've seen a range of things that Trump could do to cause damage. Is there anything that we can do or that other groups of people can do to try and limit that?
In terms of what the Democrats could be doing, I think that stuff has been kind of clear all along, that there were things that could be done and mechanisms of oversight that could be used that weren't being used. The problem with, I think, Democrats in Congress is that their mode throughout this entire presidency has been, you know, sort of outrage letters and look at this terrible thing. I think for public health officials across the rest of the country, we're in this weird place where now you have public health people saying, don't listen to the CDC, because the CDC is already giving bad advice that other public health experts don't agree with. So I feel like that is almost good preparation for what is going to happen.
You know, if you spend any time on the far right internet, you will see a tremendous amount of infighting and posturing and other kinds of macho bullshit. I don't think it would take much to sort of drive them into separate factions even. They really rely on the internet to give them coherence. And to a certain extent, they rely on the news media to give them coherence, to present them as legitimate actors in some shape or form, to define a group like the Oath Keepers as like defenders of the Constitution and not a militia. Mm. So getting the narrative right about these groups, I think, is still really important. It's something we have control over right now. For social media companies, you know, I don't necessarily expect them to act with any greater speed or skill than they have up to this point. Having this kind of activity on their platforms is still driving views. It's still driving revenue. So I don't see that actually changing all that much. But I do think that people could put pressure on them such that, you know, this does start to be a liability for them, particularly if Biden assumes office. Now they're going to have to figure out how to cozy up to that administration and act very differently. They could just also like not allow these groups to form. Like Facebook groups, it's not like those are like constitutionally required.
Right. Like Facebook, I think, has no power to prosecute pre-crime, but it absolutely has the power to say, like, we're just not going to connect you to like-minded people.
Right. We are going to stop saying that if you're interested in Jeffrey Epstein because you're following the news, perhaps you would like to join this QAnon group.
Right.
I definitely think that everybody who goes on TV today until election night should stop talking about election night and start talking about the election as a process that could take quite a bit of time.
I am hoping and praying that the networks on election night do their part and constantly explain that these are preliminary returns, that we have to wait for the full count of mail ballots, which in more than 35 states, I believe, only starts on election day. So number one, the networks convey the idea that it's no conspiracy theory if the results come out 2 or 3 or 5 days later.
I think the most important prophylactic measure that can be taken at this point is sort of just vigilance. Vigilance is important to be able to see when things start to go awry, because some of these problems, especially with, you know, sort of the transition process, especially with foreign policy, especially with destruction of public records, the further along they get in the process, the harder they are to reverse. As we saw recently with the Postal Service, if the public can raise an uproar about it earlier, if they can apply pressure sooner, they have a better chance of staving off more damage than the administration might otherwise be able to carry out.
The best way to stop Trump, if he's the loser, from doing damage in between is to be mobilized. Mass popular pressure, mass popular mobilization. Shame, 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 saying that in a million possible ways.
This is The Politics of Everything. Please subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.